welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And I am Ethan Clow, your host here on The Sector. This is episode 17 of The Sector. And as I said, talking about social justice, activism, and nonprofits. Today we're going to be talking a bit more about activism, particularly slacktivism, which is a common topic of return here on the show. We like to dive into interesting discussions about what it means to be an activist and what is this notion of armchair activism all about. And, you know, slacktivism has many different names, many different terminologies. So we're going to investigate this and perhaps from a new angle, from the point of view of how can we turn a slacktivist into an activist? So we'll get into that a bit later on in the show. First, lots to go over. First things first, happy Friday. Once again, you have made it to the end of the week, and it was a shortened week, thanks to the long weekend previously, the aforementioned BC Day. Interesting bit of news, apparently Manitoba is planning on renaming their civic holiday after one Terry Fox. Local BC boy Terry Fox, I think we can all agree, is an all-around pretty solid guy. Did a lot of great things in his life. Raised a lot of money for cancer research, and his foundation has gone on to continue that, raising a lot of money, organizing a lot of people, making a big difference in the world. Maybe we should name more of our civic holidays after Canadian icons like Terry Fox. I think that's a good idea. I mean, you know, we have enough things with BC written on it. We could use for a few more things with Terry Fox or a different sort of Canadian icon or hero. In fact, on Radio Freethinker last week, if you tuned in, you'll remember hearing me talk about World War I. And me and Don actually discussed the whole notion of Robert Borden, our wartime prime minister. He wasn't as well known as someone like Mackenzie King. Maybe that's because we don't have Robert Borden's name on as many things. You know, he's only on, what is it, the $100 bill? You know, that's such a high bill, we're not often seeing it. I mean, at least, you know, most of us don't see $100 bills very often in our hands. But maybe if we had his name on a few more things, we would remember and appreciate his accomplishments for Canada. If you can think of any other Canadian icons who deserve to have days named after them, let us know here on The Sector. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit us online at our webpage at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And of course, we are on Twitter, at sectorpodcast, as well as you can follow me at Ethan Clow, and check us out on Facebook at sectorpodcast, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. Well, as I said, lots to get onto on today's show. Great topics to discuss. We're going to get a little bit off the subject of the advocacy chill, although there is a bit of information, a bit news on that front that I do want to share with you. And again, we're still collecting your feedback on what your thoughts are on the CRA and how we should reform charity law here in this country. So again, if you have any more feedback on that, please let us know. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about some lists, actually. Some articles on some of the top power influencers of 2014, as well as some of the recent additions to Imagine Canada's Standards Program. And you might ask, well, what is Imagine Canada's Standards Program? Well, I'll fill you in on that as well. And so we'll give a little shout out to some of the stars and shining examples of nonprofits and charities going on right now. Let's take a quick commercial break here on CITR. We'll be back after this with more Sector Podcast.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good. Some bad. Matter of fact, in those days,
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca. Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure,
that's what friends are for. And we are back on the sector with me, Ethan Clow, talking about nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Now, before the break, I mentioned that I was on Radio Freethinker on Tuesday, last Tuesday. So if you missed it, tune into the podcast, and you can get that at radiofreethinker.com. We were discussing the outbreak of World War I. It was the 100th anniversary of the First World War. And made some remarkable impacts on Canada as a nation. Basically, well, I mean, changed the world, changed the course of history. So if you want to hear us talk about that and discuss some of the interesting changes, interesting cultural shifts that occurred in Canadian society, check it out. Next week on Radio Free Thinker, I'm going to be appearing again to discuss a bit more the advocacy chill that we've been talking about here on the sector. So you'll get my thoughts on it. You'll also get Dawn, and we'll discuss it a little bit more in depth, going into some of the, well, confusing factors about the CRA, but also a bit of revolution discussion. So always fun to get some of that on Radio Freethinker. Again, Tuesdays at 3 o'clock. Tune in. It'll be great. Well, on for today's show, we have some interesting things to discuss. I mentioned the advocacy chill, and again, this is still making headlines, and frankly, well, it should. Interestingly enough, there's not just Canada who is facing the nonprofit charity question with regards to regulation and politics. We also mentioned America last week in the CRA versus IRS show. Now, there's still even more in terms of international nonprofit charity shenanigans, and that's happening in Australia. Our British Commonwealth cousins in Australia are also dealing with a bit of the same problem. The Australian Liberal Party, ironically called the Liberal Party because they are a right-leaning party, but I digress, has recently proposed a bill to strip environmental charities of their charity status in Australia. It's been another step in the rung of the ladder in terms of Australian government's crackdown on environmental charities. Now, this probably signals the fact that Australia, much like Canada, is facing a resource economy in that we have things like lumber, oil, crystals, diamonds, gold, resources in the soil, in the ground, underneath forests, underneath our environment, that we want to get out. And like Canada, like Australia, the government in both cases is pretty eager to get those resources out. And again, at the expense of some pretty serious environmental concerns. BCers, of course, will be remembering what happened earlier this week with the mining spill up north in British Columbia here. So again, this is a real problem. This is a pretty big issue of concern. Now, in Canada, we're used to government officials calling certain nonprofit activists terrorists or organized crime organizations that launder money through charities. Eco-terrorists springs to mind. But those are not unheard of from Australian politicians as well. Radical and extreme minorities abusing their privileges, illegal activism. These are all terms that the Australian charitable sector has been slandered with as well. So our two nations are not all that dissimilar when it comes to dealing with a unfriendly government when it comes to social justice and environmental charities. Here in Canada, organizations like the David Suzuki Foundation, Amnesty International, the United Church of Canada, and others, especially environmental charities, are facing the crunch in terms of the CRA and this so-called political crackdown. Similarly, in Australia, we have organizations such as the Environmental Defenders Office, which is located in New South Wales, which is one of eight environmental law centers across Australia that has seen its annual funding drop. And also under the lobbying pressure of mining industry, which I think strike a bit of a chord with Canadians in that many of the complaints against environmental charities here in Canada were brought front by oil lobbyists. Now, again, not that I'm trying to encourage conspiracy thinking, and of course, you know, the who benefits logical fallacy applies here, but again, connect the dots and you see that there is a pattern here of criticism consistently being lobbied at the environmental organizations. Many commentators in Australia consider the Australian and Canadian governments twins in a sort of way, particularly when it comes to what's been quoted as political arrogance. Another organization in Australia that's faced government criticism, indeed defunding and other threats, is the Refugee Council. Now, those of you who don't realize, Australia faces sort of ongoing controversy over the number of refugees who come into the country, even though that amount is, I think, considerably less than the number of backpackers who stay over their visa limits. But again, digressing. According to some people in Australia, the idea of an advocacy chill is precisely what's happening. And again, you know, we've talked a little bit about that here and how it's perhaps improper to assume malice on the part of the CRA. Again, though, being healthy skeptics and again, being concerned citizens, it is something we should be keeping an eye on, given that here in Canada, the NDP have recently called for some pretty serious reviews of the CRA, leading to the belief that this notion that the government is perhaps more involved than they care to admit, there may be some merit to that concern. At the very least, the need to hear out and explain these circumstances, the need grows as we progress. So again, in Australia, similar problems to Canada, America, and probably the rest of the West when it comes to charities and political activities. Even though, interestingly enough, even though Australia doesn't have the same sort of political limitation that Canadian charities are dealing with, and yet the same crackdown. Interesting juxtaposition. One of the interesting things with the Australian example, though, even though they haven't seen audits, one of the mechanisms that is used to muzzle charities there is to defund them or deprive them of contracts that would normally help them fill out their budgets and do, you know, the good work that they do. What's interesting is that as these organizations face criticism from government and are unfunded, the public often takes up the slack. And in many ways, the public sort of motivated by the partisan politics that are coming out of government and sort of the mean-spirited way that these charities are being talked about, ironically, makes them more supported. Many of the charities come out of it ahead with more donations, a more galvanized fan base is the wrong word, of course, more galvanized supporter base who is there to help them and who will ultimately be able to fund them in a way that gives them more leeway and more freedom. So it kind of backfired for the Australian government in that sense. But ultimately, time will tell. Much like the CRA, Australia has their own regulatory bodies, and in fact, they're going through their own sort of reforms. So it ultimately will depend on how things go in the future and to what extent the Australian government is able to put their hands into the charity sector down in Oz. Well, let's take a quick break here on the sector. We will return after this.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
And we're back on The Sector. So I mentioned before that we have some lists to discuss. So the Nonprofit Times, one of the websites that aggregates news and information and events about the nonprofit sector in America, has recently published their top 50. These are the power and influencers who exemplify what it means to be a influencer in the nonprofit world. To quote from the article, those selected for inclusion in this year's The Nonprofit Times Power and Influence Top 50 exemplify those words. The words being a quote from Irish philosopher Edmund Burke, "Justice is itself the great standing policy of civil society, and any imminent departure from it, under any circumstances, lies under the suspicion of being no policy at all." During the past 12 months, there has been an increased emphasis on effective implementation of a more civil society. That has taken the form of demanded inclusion, beginning to affect change in the way in which the general public views the sector and evolving those expectations or the simple use of language. So the Nonprofit Times has put together a list of these top 50 influencers in the sector. Obviously, 50 is a bit long for us to go through them one by one. Of course, the usual suspects like Bill Gates are there. There's also people that you may not have heard of, like Emmett Carlson, who is the president of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, Charles Best, founder and CEO of DonorsChoose.org, Michael Chapman, senior vice president of philanthropy at the Community Foundation of the Ozarks, Brian Gallagher, president and CEO of United Way Worldwide. So, I mean, names that you recognize, some that you don't. Many of these, pretty much all of these organizations, are American by nature. Some of them are international organizations, but most of them have their headquarters in America, were started by Americans, and are largely run by Americans. Of course, that's perfectly fine. We love Americans. It's a great example, though, of celebrating the accomplishments and the, you know, hard work that goes into running nonprofits and making these organizations successful, of fundraising millions upon millions of dollars that are having a real impact in society and are generating change. That's one of the more fantastic things I like about lists like this. And I think that the nonprofit sector, not just in America, not just in Canada, but everywhere, I think we have a kind of aversion to celebrating our accomplishments. Like we're too humble. And that's probably a symptom of the sector. We're by nature, we're do-gooders. We like to help people. We like to fundraise, and we like to make a difference, and we like to be difference makers who are tuned into the problems and trying to fix society. We're not great at, you know, waving a flag and saying, you know, look at all the great stuff that I've done. Yay me. But sometimes we probably should do that. We should shine a light on all of our hard work, because again, it's not easy. And we want to change the public perception of what the nonprofit world is like. I've mentioned before on the show that the public tends to look at a charity in a very sort of 1950s way, in that we picture a church basement somewhere full of grandmas who knit things and bake things and occasionally phone people. We don't picture hardworking people who work from like 9 o'clock till 9 p.m., who are constantly on their phone getting emails from board directors, who are scheduling late night meetings and video conferences, correcting mistakes, going over forms, combing through data. We don't see that side of the nonprofit sector. We only ever really talk about the inspirational, look at all the great things that we've done. And that's fantastic. I think inspiration is great. But we should also talk about the realism and the hard work that goes into making that inspiration happen. I want to just read a bit more from the the list created by the nonprofit Times, just to sort of hammer home the point that they're making, but also what I've just been talking about. This unveiling of the industry's innovators illustrates the power of people pushing society for equal access and opportunity. While that concept has always been the sector's hallmark, recently it seems that the insistence for inclusion has needed ratcheting up, and the sector leaders have responded. The call has been answered with ideas, technology, action, and persuasion. In some cases, they have put themselves physically on the line for equality and access. Strategy and tactics have been important, but so has the way sector leaders and the general public view what nonprofit organizations mean to the greater society. So I think that kind of hammers home the point once again that there's more to the nonprofit sector than donating money and getting a card from the beneficiary with a big thank you. That's important, but it's not the only thing. I mean, the people, the volunteers, the employees, they're all working hard. There's an ongoing struggle to make sure that the public sees the nonprofit sector as relevant and as having an impact. And again, that goes back to what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks here on the sector, of making sure that the public understands all of the hard work, all of the effort, the blood, sweat, and tears. It happens. Sometimes, you know, you trip and you fall and you bleed a little bit. So that's a true statement. But nevertheless, the public should understand all of that effort because it's there. It's in the work. And we don't want to give the wrong impression. We don't want the CRA to have the wrong impression. We don't want newspaper reporting about a charity being audited to instantly make people think, oh, you know, those nonprofit people are just as bad as everybody else and they're all in it for the money and blah, 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 blah. We want people to understand the hard work that goes into it, not so much for our accolades, but so that the sector is healthy and strong and every year gets healthier and stronger. Well, let's move on to the other list here on the show. Now, the other list that I talked about was Imagine Canada's Standards Program. Now, what is the Standards Program from Imagine Canada? The program is designed to strengthen an organization's capacity in the charitable and nonprofit sector. The program's mission is to build excellence within Canada's charities and nonprofits through common standards of practice and to strengthen the confidence in the sector. So essentially, it is a system of monitoring policies and practices designed to allow charities to put this up as saying, we are accredited, we have signed on with Imagine Canada's standards program. It is a transparent and on the books, really good system. It demonstrates that we're going to be good stewards of your donations. It demonstrates that we are qualified leaders of our organization. It's a way to sort of standardize, but also a way to showcase how good we are as an organization who, you know, goes through with this process, how good they are at demonstrating their prudence, their good planning. And it's not an easy system to get. It's not like you write a check to Imagine Canada and they stamp you. It's a rigorous process of checking, resource examination, documentation examination. It's kind of like an audit. So it's not an easy thing. But many charities are going through with it and they are using the standards program as a way to demonstrate some pretty good progress to the Canadian public. What's in the standards, Ethan? You might ask. You might say, Ethan, why do these standards make a difference? Well, the standards, and you can download this from Imagine Canada's webpage, and I will have it in the show notes, is divided into different categories. So, for example, board governance, financial accountability and transparency, fundraising, staff management, and volunteer involvement. The process includes a 73 list of standards that the charity has to qualify for. There are different standard levels. So, for example, if you're an organization with up to 5 full-time employees and up to $2 million in annual expenses, you're at one level. If you're an organization with up to 50 full-time employees and up to $10 million in annual expenses, and of course, if you're an organization with more than 50 full-time employees or more than $10 million in annual expenses, you're all sort of on different levels. So there's different accreditation levels for, you know, your organization depending on size, which makes sense, of course. You wouldn't have an organization that's a small shop be classified or go through the same rigorous process as an organization that is significantly larger. There is an accreditation process, there is a fee process, and a license fee. Again, you know, there is some money involved in this, but of course, the kickback is that with Imagine Canada Standards Review, your organization looks more trustworthy and looks more transparent for the donor. And then you go through the process, the application process, there's peer review process, there is a compliance and renewal process. And again, you go through everything. You go through board governance at different levels. They go through oversight, leadership. So, I mean, it's a long process, but again, it's designed to give an independent third-party look at your organization. If the organization passes, if it gets good marks, then you can take that to the public and say, again, look, someone has vetted us. We've gone through the process. We are trustworthy. And hopefully that will result in more engagement from your donor base and more trust from the general public. Now, the new organizations who have gone through the process, there's quite a few of them, so I won't name them all. But I mean, just a couple that pop out, the Autism Canada Foundation, the BC Cancer Foundation, the British Columbia SPCA. These are all pretty worthy organizations, I must say. The Edmonton Food Bank, the Feed Nova Scotia, the Elizabeth Fry Society of Greater Vancouver, the John Howard Society of Waterloo Wellington, some, again, good organizations, the Royal Ontario Museum Governors, the Rick Hansen Foundation, the PLE, Community Service Society of BC. Excellent, excellent work on behalf of these charities to take this extra step to assure their donors and the public of their standards, of their transparency. It's a great step, and something that another great way I think that the industry can self-regulate itself. Now, normally when you hear the word self-regulate, you probably should have alarm bells go off in your head. But I think in this case, it's actually a really important aspect that the nonprofit sector recognizes the need for trust, that we recognize the need for an understanding with the public that we are taking money and that it's being properly looked after. That's something that, well, obviously means a whole lot for the nonprofit sector. And the fact that Imagine Canada is able to do this, you know, you combine that in conjunction with all the charity law that we have, it makes a really strong case for why the nonprofit sector should be healthy, why it should be growing, and why it should be seeing success. Sometimes you see reports that, oh, well, the nonprofit sector is rich, that it's doing so well, that it's a multi-million dollar industry here in Canada. Well, and it should be, because it's a multi-million dollar system that needs a lot of support. There are a lot of causes out there. You scroll through this list of new organizations that have been accredited. And again, there are a lot of organizations here. There are hospitals, there are childhood foundations, there are food banks, there are educational foundations. There is a lot of work that needs to be done. And again, it makes sense because these organizations do take in a lot of money, and it helps them be more reputable to the donor public. Again, if you are curious, we will have the link to the list on the Sector Podcast website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. So if you are curious, maybe your favorite charity is on Imagine Canada, let us know, and go check them out. Again, it's a great process, and it will help everyone be a bit more trusting when it comes to donating to a charity. Well, let's take another quick break here on the sector. We will return after this.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action, wizard, you shall not pass, cut! Sir Ian.
And we are back on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Now, at the start of the show, I mentioned the question of engagement and slacktivism. Now, this is old hat for us. We've talked about slacktivism before. But what's interesting is, how do we take a slacktivist? And let's, for the sake of this argument, assume that they exist. So you have a slacktivist. And, you know, they're clicking and they're signing petitions and they're emailing the petitions to their friends and they're, you know, tweeting pictures of themselves holding up a sign with a message on it, encouraging action of some sort. You know, they're not directly taking action themselves. They're not attending meetings or donating. They are not getting involved. They aren't volunteering. You know, none of the traditional forms of activism are taking place. We just have this online activity. You know, are they forever going to be armchair activists, or is there a way to convert that energy into something that's more productive? Well, one of the ways that you might do that is with the engagement pyramid. And that's right, I said engagement pyramid, not the donor pyramid, of which we've talked about previously, but the engagement pyramid. And this is a pyramid, obviously, chronicling 6 levels of connecting people with their social change. Now, the higher up you go on the pyramid, the better off you are, I guess, in terms of engagement, the more engaged and involved you are as you go up. And like the pyramid, and like the donor pyramid, for instance, the bottom, the base, the largest section is often made up of the people who are least engaged. This is the vast majority of people, and you try to maneuver them up, progressing them ultimately into donors and fully engaged members of your community organization. Now, the 6 levels to the engagement pyramid, starting at the bottom, again, the widest area, is level 1, observing. You graduate from observing into following, which is level 2, to level 3, which is endorsing, to level 4, which is contributing, to level 5, which is owning, and finally level 6, which is leading. As I said, the vertical dimension is like a ladder in which the individual climbs up as they get more involved in a particular organization or campaign. To mention this, of course, we'll have links to this on our show notes so you can learn more about the engagement pyramid. Some of the same criticisms could be labeled at the pyramid of engagement in the same way that we label criticisms at the donor pyramid. Now, obviously, it's not always a one-way streak going up the mountain. With anything, engagement is going to wane. It's going to get lower. It's going to go up. It'll go down. It'll kind of go sideways at times. And, you know, there's no real easy binary way to explain that. And a pyramid is handy for sort of visualizing the overall process, but it's not going to be a totally inclusive, true, 100% of the time method of thinking. It's only going to be true, you know, maybe 75% of the time. And even then, organizations may not have 6 levels. There may not even be really a need for 6 levels for every organization. Maybe there's only 2 or 3. So keep that in mind as you examine the engagement pyramid. So what are the individual levels like? What does it mean when we say you're in the observing stage? So at level 1 of the observing stage, you're at the bottom of the pyramid, and the primary engagement goals are to inspire initial and repeat contact with the organization. The person, the engaged person in this case, is interested in the cause. They're aware of the organization. Awareness is the major factor. They care enough about the organization's existence, but they don't really have any kind of reason or opportunity to investigate firsthand. The nature is sporadic, indirect communication. The person takes occasional, distracted glances at the organization's work. These indirect communications may be by word of mouth, social media, traditional media. They may visit the webpage, but they don't provide contact information, so any direct communication is at their initiative. The communication at this level is purely focused on information sharing and awareness building. The desire in this case is you want to motivate somebody to visit the webpage, attend an event, a low barrier entry point to gain more information about the organization. You know, some really good examples of this, hearing about an organization from a friend at work or via email or through Facebook or Twitter. If you've ever been on Facebook and you see one of your friends and they go, oh, hey, Dave liked a podcast called The Sector. Huh. The Sector. Interesting. That's observing. I've just been observed. So then the person might visit the Sector Podcast website, which is at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And they may look around. Oh, okay. So it's a podcast, radio show, some guy named Ethan, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Good. And they move on, you know. The goal, of course, from the sector's point of view, is how do we get this person to maybe commit to a more engaged level? So we might want them to download the podcast, have a listen, have a sample, sort of get an idea of what we do here on the show. The metrics that we can use is looking at website traffic or recognition polling, or even just seeing how many insights we're getting on Facebook. This leads to level two, which is known as following. So this is where the engaged in question is interested, they're understanding about the organization, they care somewhat about what we're trying to do. And, you know, if you could verbalize it, they might say something like, I care enough to sort of include you on my incoming communication, but there's no guarantee that I'm going to follow up. So, you know, they might be following you on Twitter or on Facebook. They may occasionally check into your website or follow you, your blog, perhaps. The engagement goal for this is you want to offer value and eventually secure the permission to deliver more proactive communication. So, you know, what that sort of translates into is that you want to get them on your mailing list. It is regular direct communication. I mean, you are posting things on Facebook or on Twitter for the purpose of getting seen. But ultimately, it's still quite passive in that they can really choose to ignore you at no real extra effort on their part. And again, you're trying to get them to provide you with that contact information and that permission for more formal communication. And to measure this, you would look at things like newsletter subscriptions, your open and click-through metrics, RSS subscriptions, Twitter follower, Facebook fans, that sort of thing. And this naturally bleeds into the next level of engagement, which is endorsing. And that's where you've earned enough trust to secure an endorsement of the work. And again, this also kind of blends into Facebook and Twitter because by following you, by liking you, by doing one of those actions, it isn't in a way a public endorsement. If, you know, John's friends see that he's liked The Sector, to a certain extent, that is John saying, I like this enough to want to receive regular updates. And given the social nature of Facebook and Twitter, that's the implied thing is that maybe you will like it too. So at this level, you've earned enough trust to secure endorsement of the work. And that's very important. The mindset of the person believes in the mission. They trust the organization enough to approve of their use. They are willing to attach their name to the organization. They will share particular campaigns. They may even make a decision to include a financial contribution, a small donation here and there, membership fees maybe. it's not necessarily saying that I'm going to become a major donor or I'm going to become a repeated donor, but you've given me enough to think about. I clearly trust you. And so here's a bit of financial donations. Give me more. It's a straightforward form of engagement, step-by-step transactional form of relationship. They enter into regular direct mass communication designed to inform, designed to motivate future interest. It's, in terms of fundraising, at this stage, you are regularly giving them simple calls to action for donations, usually only a couple times a year, if you're a smart charity. And again, the examples of this include low-level membership pledges, forwarding email, petition signing, and again, maybe becoming a more engaged fan on Facebook and Twitter. Low levels of endorsement in that case. Now, the next level up is contributing. And this is where we start to broaden the commitment of the engaged. They contribute significant time, financial, or social capital to your organization. So this is, if we're talking about social media, they're retweeting, they are tweeting at you, they are sharing posts, they are taking efforts that they can to help you get your word out there. And they're probably becoming more involved in terms of donations, making a regular contribution, maybe even becoming a monthly donor. They also are interacting with you a bit more. So instead of just kind of here and there email newsletters, it's regular direct mass communication that's designed to inform, it's designed to give a personal insight into the organization, and you add to that periodic personal email, phone calls, face-to-face. Again, this person is now invested enough that they're giving you money. You also have to escalate your level of commitment to them. What's important to remember is that at this stage, it's not based on impulse. It's consideration that motivates a donation or letter writing or whatever thing you're trying to get them to do. They are now no longer doing it because there's a cute picture of a dog or it's a funny picture or it's a meme. They're actually being like, what amount should I give to that organization this year? And they're really thinking about it, and you got to respect that. And that is going to be sort of how you graduate people up, is by escalating with them as their interest level increases. So the way to measure something like this, of course, is your growth of volunteers, your donor growth, your conversion and renewal rates, the amount of time volunteers give you. This will all help you understand how many people you have at this level four of engagement. The next level up is owning, level five. This is a fully invested person in your organization and mission. They possess mission-relevant knowledge and skills that are major factors. This is the dedicated volunteer stage. This is somebody who has been involved for most likely a long time. They understand the ins and outs of what you're trying to do. In fact, they may understand it better than you do. The nature of the engagement is ongoing. They attend weekly meetings. They occasionally Skype in to important national meetings. They attend conferences. They donate in meaningful ways. They help train volunteers. It is a major level of engagement. You don't usually have a lot of people at this level, and they're very important. People in the owning phase help you run the organization. So very important level of investment. You monitor this through more subjective measures, because at this stage, it's harder to put these people on a graph somewhere. So you go through personal interviews and surveys. You have a lot of face-to-face conversations. And after all, I mean, these people, you trust their feedback. You trust their judgment. So that's going to help you understand where they are within the organization. And then finally, at the top of the pyramid, you have leading. And this is where the engaged person develops leadership skills. They actually become people who are stewarding other people on the engagement pyramid. They're carrying out organizational work. They're being trusted with major tasks. They put their hand up. They volunteer for the difficult projects. There is regular, ongoing, day-to-day communication, face-to-face communication, and it's often initiated by the person, not the organization. And again, this could be something like a board member or an associate member or an advisor to the organization at this stage. So it's a deep level of commitment. As with the previous example, you can't really quantify this the same way that you would the lower levels. You have to really get face-to-face with somebody with interviews and examinations. And again, what's interesting is that at this level, it's more them initiating it with you, because they're coming to you with ideas. They're in a leadership role, so they're also looking at ways that the organization can improve. At this point, you know, they're not talking about you, the organization. They're talking about us, the organization. People begin using the term we instead of you. And that's happening at the previous level. It's happening at this level. And it's so engaged that all of their energy now becomes focused on this mission, this leadership role that they're now in. You can imagine that at this level, it is a lot less common. I mean, people don't necessarily make it to the leading level. There's maybe only one organization that the average activist will reach this level with. And again, it makes it really important that when they do reach this level, that you are being a good steward, that the organization is helping to keep you there and make sure that you're looked after in that sense. One of the problems is that when you're at this sort of deep level, the danger of burnout becomes all the more likely. That somebody who gets to this level, they might get dissatisfied, they might get burnt out, and they may quit. So it's really important to try to have a system for catching people who fall off the pyramid. Sort of like a catcher in the rye kind of thing going on there, without the teenage angst. And you have these catchers who, you know, you have someone in the leadership position and they get burnt out and they're like, oh, I can't deal with this anymore. And you catch them as they fall down the pyramid and you pull them in at like level two or something. So they're still engaged. They're still a part of the organization, but they're getting that breather. They're getting that break. And this is, again, to sort of hammer home the point, not all organizations are going to have this binary progression. You're going to have a slowed and jumpy and up and down wavy sense of engagement, because people are going to move in and out and they're going to move sideways. They're going to go from being engaged on one platform to being engaged on another platform. You may have multiple streams in your organization. In fact, almost every nonprofit does have multiple streams. And what I mean by that is that you may promote environmental protection in one stream, advocacy in another stream, corporate accountability in another stream. The list goes on. You could have a focus that is more politically generated, where you're engaging more with letters to your MP type thing. Or you could have a more grassroots focus, where you're engaged with the average person on the street. So people may move sideways. They may get involved in both. They may be involved in both at a lower level than somebody who's involved at one at a higher level. And this is all sort of the method of tracking, because if you don't know where everybody is on your pyramid, you know, they could get lost. And that's no good, because if they do drop off at that point, you may lose them forever. So that's the engagement pyramid. It's a bit more in-depth, I think, than the donor pyramid was, but let us know what you think. You know, we talked about the idea of retiring the donor pyramid, or at least modifying it to make it more dynamic. So what do you think? Is the engagement pyramid dynamic enough? Is it too dynamic? Can it be too dynamic? I don't know about that one. But let us know your thoughts on this. Email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And of course, we are on Twitter and Facebook, where you can engage and endorse us. See what I did there? See what I did? I referenced back the engagement pyramid. That's called good radio, folks. So we are running out of time here on The Sector, episode 17, on the engagement pyramid episode. So with the big question of the week, I know that we sort of delayed it last time and the week before about reforming the Canadian charitable sector, how can we make changes happen for things like the CRA, but also regulation in general? What do we want nonprofits, charities to be regulated with? It's a bit of a big question, and I'm going to ask you to, again, keep thinking about it. I want to get some more feedback on this. You know, this can be kind of our ongoing big question, because we're going to keep coming back to this topic again and again. Maybe we can bring on some industry experts and ask them about this, what they think needs to be done to regulate the sector. In the meantime, let's think about engagement. Let's think about the engagement pyramid. What do you think about this? Do you think that this applies strongly enough to the nonprofit sector? What about slacktivism? You know, this notion of the armchair activist who, in between games of Minecraft, clicks a petition on Facebook, likes a post, retweets something on Twitter. And, you know, is that enough? Is that enough, even at the low levels of the engagement pyramid, to indicate growth and to indicate that someone's going to move up that scale? A lot of the complaints about slacktivism have been related to this notion of, you know, likes don't feed hungry children, likes don't amount to anything. But maybe that's not the point. Maybe, sure, liking something doesn't make a difference. Maybe that's a stupid waste of time. But maybe it's not the end result of the likes. Maybe it is the end result of the engagement. Maybe it means that every time you like something, you get a little bit closer to moving up the engagement pyramid. And as you go up, and as you sign petitions, and as you follow things on Twitter, and as you retweet, you go up, you start endorsing, you start contributing. Maybe that is what we should be more concerned about. Maybe it's not so much the method we use to engage, but the engagement itself. What do you think about that? I'm curious. So that's our big question of the week. Can engagement simply be slacktivism? Does it have to be direct, proactive engagement? Can it simply be as basic, as easy, as low barrier as liking a Facebook post? What are your thoughts on that? Again, you know how to contact us. The big question of the week. Love to hear your feedback on that. Well, we have reached the end of another episode of The Sector. Absolute privilege to be talking with you today on this wonderful Friday morning. I hope you have a fantastic weekend, and I hope you will join us next week on The Sector. And be sure to tune in on Radio Free Thinker this upcoming Tuesday at 3 o'clock to hear more of me talking about nonprofits with the advocacy chill going on. So until next week, thank you for listening, and see you soon. This is Ethan Clough on The Sector.
Up on the roof with Robin and Jake, we play tunes and you wake up on the roof. CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, up on the roof with Robin and Jake.
Good morning.
Good morning, listeners. You're tuned in to Up on the Roof, as you just heard.
We are broadcasting to you live from CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, live at UBC campus.
And we play tunes when you wake up.
Up on the roof.
Up on the roof.
This show is specifically for anyone who's waking up on a roof.
Well, we are going away next week.
But don't fear not, because we've timed it. So we leave on a Sunday, come back on a Thursday. We will not miss any Up on the Roofs.
Oh, well, I did some bad math then. yeah, but we're going up to Slocan, and I'm feeling good. We've got an adventure coming, vacation. I quit my job last night.
Yay!
So,
how does it feel to be a free?
It feels so good.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't have to talk about spirulina. I don't have to make smoothies. I don't have to juice kale.
And we won't mention any proper names or anything, but Robin used to work in the coffee and juice bar of a large
prominent upscale health retail food store.
Grocery store, yeah.
Yeah. I had a pretty good time working there, but I was ready to leave.
I had fun coming in and saying, "Hey, Robin," and then getting like coffees or whatever and buying groceries.
Yep.
Well, let's kick off the morning with some great music.
Let's do just that. Here for you, we have a relatively older now CD from Jay Arner. It's called Midnight on South Granville, and the song is Bird of Prey.